I'm now joined by James Seifert, ETF analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence. James is an excellent all-around resource on ETFs. I would say nobody covers the crypto ETF landscape as well as James does, who is now on the line with me from New Jersey. James, great finally having you on the podcast. Thanks for joining me.
Yes, I'm happy to be here.
All right, so we're
long-time listener, I guess.
No, and it's great finally having you here, and we're going to preview the year in ETFs. I think a lot of different directions we can head, but I think we have to start with Bitcoin and crypto ETFs, right? A favorite topic for both of us. Obviously, we got the first Bitcoin futures ETFs in 2021. Still no spot Bitcoin ETF, which, by the way, I need to trademark that saying. But look, I'll tell you, I'm not optimistic about the chances we see a spot Bitcoin ETF this year. I just don't feel like SEC Chair Gary Gensler is there. It seems like he wants much more regulation around crypto exchanges and the underlying crypto market. And to me, that just seems like it's going to take a while. That's not going to happen overnight. So to start, do you agree with that? And then what else are you watching for with crypto ETFs this year?
So I also agree with that. I think the SEC has just repeatedly showed us they're just not ready and they're not having it with the spot Bitcoin ETF. But there are a few things that people aren't talking about. There's a lot of people out there that just kind of see this as the SEC is denying it. It's not going to happen and nothing is changing. But there are a lot of undercurrents that are changing and that I'm looking forward to specifically in the spring of 2022 to kind of dictate where this thing goes. Could we see one at the end of 2022? And I'm at this point pretty optimistic that I think we'll get one in 23. But again, that's a whole year away. And we can get it. We can dive into why that is.
Well, no, I'd love to hear more. I mean, what are some of those undercurrents?
Yeah, so the way this whole process works, you've discussed it on your podcast. The futures ETFs we have now are filed under the 1940 Act, and they don't have to go through this 19b4 process. We don't want to go down too deep into the hole about like why that is, but essentially they didn't have to go through the same process that spot Bitcoin ETFs have to go through, and the Division of Trading and Markets of the SEC keeps denying them. So Gary Gensler on August 3rd basically told issuers, apply under the 40 Act with Bitcoin futures and wink, wink, we'll see what happens. And that's what happened. We had an approval. And I said from after Van Eck was denied, when I read the denial letter for Van Eck and some of these other issuers that have been denied since then at the end of November through just the week before 2022, I didn't think that based on their reasoning for the denial with the market issues with the potential manipulation, no oversight in the underlying market. My thought process was, even if a Bitcoin futures product went through this 19b4 process, it would get denied by the SEC's decision-making process, the way they view the market. So, but uniquely, we have a couple of ETFs coming up due for that 19b4 decision from the SEC at the beginning of April. So we have 2 PM on April 8th, the decision is due. And then we also have another Valkyrie futures-based ETF that's under the 33 Act due for the 19b4. So what this does is it kind of opens the SEC to a form of attack. They kind of have to make a decision here. They've been very iffy on their reasoning, and they haven't defined what a market of significant size is. We have this grayscale letter that went to the SEC citing the Administrative Procedures Act, which basically says that it needs to treat like situations alike. And if they don't, that the SEC can be sued for not treating situations that are similarly. So what happens here is if they deny on April 8th, as I suspect they would have if this futures ETF filing went through the 19b4 process before they approved the 1940 Act ETF, then that opens them up, I believe, to a lawsuit. And our crypto litigation analyst also thinks there's a chance that the SEC could lose such a lawsuit, but obviously that would be to be determined. So then that leaves them with another option, which is they have to approve these futures ETFs under the 19b4 process. And what that does, in my mind, is it kind of takes away some of their arguments against the Bitcoin underlying futures market and saying that the futures market isn't of significant size, but then they're going to approve a Bitcoin futures ETF. And then you take a step back and you look at the way these futures are priced, they're based on the spot market. So the SEC says the spot market is subject to manipulation, but then the Bitcoin futures are actually priced based off of those underlying spot markets, so five different crypto exchanges, which is exactly how a Bitcoin spot ETF would trade. So essentially what's going to happen here is we're going to have to see how the SEC handles these futures ETFs that are filed in the 1994 process, and then see what happens with some of these more filings. If Grayscale is denied in the beginning of July, that's when their final date is to convert GBTC, I could see Grayscale filing an APA lawsuit to try and go there. And again, that lawsuit could take a year, maybe more, before it's tied out. So that could be to 2023, but maybe the SEC decides they don't want to deal with that. I still think the odds of getting an ETF, a spot Bitcoin ETF, in 2022 are below 50%, but I think they're not quite as low as many people make them out to be because of all these different reasons.
That was a fantastic description, and I want to hone in on two points that you made, and I think these are part of this argument that Grayscale is mounting through that Administrative Procedure Act, the APA violation that you mentioned. And again, that's that, you know, they're effectively making the case Bitcoin futures are priced off of exchanges like Coinbase and Gemini, exactly like a spot Bitcoin ETF would be. There's no difference there. And you and I have talked about this. I know out on Twitter that if somebody manipulates the spot Bitcoin market, that's going to impact the futures market. These two markets are intertwined. They don't exist in a vacuum. They're not siloed here. And so you can't say that you're okay with the futures market and the pricing there, but not be okay with the spot market. And I would say vice versa. And then the other point that you made, which I completely agree with, is that the SEC has denied spot Bitcoin ETFs by saying that the CME Bitcoin futures market isn't big enough. But of course, they approve Bitcoin futures ETFs holding those same futures. I think those are the two, you know, key issues that they're going to have to grapple with here. And I think you're right that if we get into legal proceedings, it's going to be tough for them to overcome. Now, I always think the SEC's in a position of power here anytime you get into litigation or a legal situation, right? The onus is going to be on Grayscale and the other ETF issuers. But those are, in my opinion, two pretty compelling arguments.
Yeah, I would just say I've been saying this from the get-go for over a year now. I really think the SEC has lost the forest for the trees here. They're focused on bureaucratic minutiae, a whole bunch of different things that, like, if you take a big step back, you're like, a spot Bitcoin ETF is better for everyone involved. If people at this point know what Bitcoin is, it's not like some obscure thing that people don't understand. They understand what it is. And I think they're focused on just really small things. And you look at what they've approved BitO, and don't get me wrong, there are plenty of people out there to say BitO is worthless, but it is a good product. It's a good trading product. It trades tight. There's no commissions. If you're trading crypto directly, you end up paying a lot of commissions to trade that. But BitO is versus the actual spot Bitcoin market is off by 3%. So it's underperformed the spot Bitcoin market by 3% because of those roll costs. We're not even 3 months in. So, I mean, for all those reasons, it just makes sense that a spot Bitcoin ETF should be approved, in my opinion. And there's a lot of issuers out there. There's a lot of legal firepower being put towards the SEC to get this approved. But the SEC has put their foot down pretty strongly, saying they don't care about all these different reasons. And they're worried about manipulation of the underlying market. They want surveillance agreements. They've actually cited, like, some stablecoin issues they're worried about. So there's all these things that they're worried about. So we'll see, again, how they handle things in the beginning of April. That's what I'm watching for now.
Let me ask you this, and then I do want to move on to some other topics. I'm going to be posting my 2022 ETF predictions probably tomorrow, but by Thursday for sure. And I'll spill the beans on one of them now. One of them is going to be that I think Ethereum futures ETFs will be approved this year. And, you know, it's interesting. We were talking about treating similar situations alike, these APA violations. My logic here is pretty simple. It goes back to Gensler and the fact that if he is comfortable with CME-traded Bitcoin futures held in a 1940 Act ETF, then I don't see any reason why he shouldn't be comfortable with CME-traded Ether futures held in a 40 Act wrapper. It just doesn't seem defensible to me to approve one and not the other. And from my standpoint, there appears to be plenty of liquidity in Ether futures. Last I checked, about a third of the volume and open interest of Bitcoin futures. But that seems like plenty to work with. I guess briefly here, do you agree with that?
So, yeah, I've actually said in my pieces looking forward to 2022 that Ethereum futures ETF is likely to come before a spot Bitcoin ETF based on the SEC comments. But there are a few things that I can push back. So I agree with you broadly speaking. I think we will get one, but there are a few negatives. So the first is, the one positive is that when Gensler came out and said a 1940 Act futures ETF is what a Bitcoin ETF filer should pursue, Bitcoin open interest in the CME futures market was about 1.3 million. Ethereum futures peaked at that level, but now they're about 700 million. So it's decently off that. The other thing is, obviously, Ethereum futures only started in 2021, I believe February of 2021, so there's a little bit less history. And then the final thing is the FCM issues, the futures commission merchants. There was a huge issue because there was so much demand for the Bitcoin futures as you have Ditto and Valkyrie's launch that the other issuers couldn't launch because there wasn't enough balance sheet essentially for these futures commission merchants, which kind of act as the middlemen in these futures markets. So if there's more risk, more volatility and things like that, they have to use their balance sheet to offset that and make markets. And I think maybe they're a little bit worried about the market not being big enough. They might put a little bit of higher standard on the market being large enough before they launch an Ethereum futures ETF. So those are the counterpoints I would offer, but I also agree. I think we should see an Ethereum futures ETF in 2022.
It's going to be fascinating to watch. And hey, you never know. Maybe we'll both end up being wrong and there will be a spot Bitcoin ETF. But I just love tracking this story. All right, we're running a little bit short on time. I should have known that we get hung up on the crypto topic. I should have allocated like a whole hour for us to talk about that. But let's go rapid fire here. I'm just going to tee up some topics and just give me your quick take on these. So first, obviously, 2021 was a banner year for ETFs overall, 900 plus billion in inflows, record number of launches. I'm curious, looking ahead, I know you're obviously bullish on the future of ETFs, but what are you expecting in terms of like continued adoption moving forward? Where do you think we are in the overall life cycle of ETFs?
Yeah, so basically from like 2004 till first quarter of 2019, everything on the, especially on the equity side. So if we look at things from the equity perspective, if we break it down to active versus passive and mutual funds versus ETFs, because that's the most data we have, basically passive equity was taking in money hand over fist every single quarter without issue. And that's kind of changed in the fourth quarter of 2019. We had this 12-ish month of middling where there was inflows and outflows to the index equity mutual funds. And then all of a sudden, after the downturn, so March 2020, the pandemic, blah, 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 we saw a change. We've seen outflows pretty much every quarter since then to index equity mutual funds. And we've seen massive, as we've highlighted, you've highlighted, there's been massive inflows into equity ETFs and ETFs in general, active equity ETFs as well. So basically, there's been this entire change of regime. So historically, it was active to passive, but we really cited it more as high cost to low cost. That's the way we typically spoke about it. But now we're seeing this actual structural shift from mutual funds to ETFs, in our opinion. Now, not all of those index equity mutual fund outflows are solely going to ETFs. Some of it is also going to CITs and different things like that, so we can't see that, which are a little more opaque market. But it's definitely happening where ETFs are sucking up the assets from mutual funds. And we're also seeing it in ETF mutual fund to ETF conversions.
James, when you look at the composition of flows into ETFs, I'm curious where you think issuers can find success moving forward. And the way I would frame this is, I know you and Eric Balchunas like to talk about this cheap versus shiny object phenomenon. I actually talked about this earlier with ETF Trends, Laura Krieger, a little bit too, right? Where investors are plowing money into the cheapest core building block ETFs, the Vanguards, the iShares of the world, and then they're spicing things up around the edges of their portfolios with thematic ETFs and those sorts of things. Do you see anything changing with that moving forward? Obviously, it's been a good recipe for success for the ETF industry overall when you look at flows, but is that the future of ETFs?
Yeah, so that's the way that we view it. That's the way that Eric and I and our team kind of looks at this. So here's a really cool stat from our 2022 outlook. In 2018, almost 99% of ETF flows went to ETFs charging 20 basis points or less, which is an amazing stat. But for 2021, that's only about 72%. And that's because we're seeing this barbelling. People want these thematic ETFs. They want these high active share to active ETFs, like the ARK ETFs. And a lot of people talk about them as being bad investments that are for long-term investments, but they're I feel like people in the industry are kind of do this like hand wagging or finger wagging about like these are not good products for long-term investments, but they kind of miss the bigger picture that a lot of people are doing this core satellite approach where they have their core, most of their investments in the passive, large, passive market cap weighted ETFs or mutual funds, whatever it may be, and they don't touch it. But then they like to do things on the edge with these products that I'm talking about, the things that tend to charge more. They're going to have way more volatility. It's a little bit more like gambling. It can be fun for some people, and it helps them stay away from touching that core part of their portfolio. So I think that investing can be fun for some people, and that's what they're doing. And we're seeing it show up in the flows and the data. As I mentioned, 99% in 2018 with the ETFs charging 22 basis points or less. That number is down to 72% in 2021, which is an amazing stat. And we did not see that coming necessarily. That went down more than we predicted.
Just a couple minutes left here. On that shiny object front, I know you and the Bloomberg ETF team, you publish a piece titled 22 ETFs to Watch in 2022. I'm just curious, are there a couple of ETFs you can highlight here, maybe something off the beaten path a little bit?
Yeah, so we do this every year. We've done 20 for 2020 and 21 for 21. Now we're doing 22 for 22. I don't know if or when we're going to stop that. but I'll talk about the ones I did. I did BIDO, which is the futures Bitcoin futures ETF and GBTC. We talked enough about them, so that's the crypto side of things. The other one, I did three others that I wrote about. And to be clear, these aren't like our predictions on good ETFs. They're just ETFs that we're watching because they're interesting and they might focus on certain trends. So one of them is VOTE, which is the engine number one ESG ETF, and they do things through activist investment. And I find this extremely interesting as a way to attack the ESG ETF landscape. They're doing pretty decently well, pulling in a bunch of assets. So we're going to be watching this to see how this does versus the more traditional way that people are attacking the ESG world. The other thing I highlighted were interest rate hedge ETFs, which has been around basically since people have been calling for the Fed to raise rates back in 2011, 2013. And they really haven't taken off with that many assets until this past year. They've significantly grown. So things like IGHG, LQDH. So we'll see how I'm going to be watching that market to see if they take off and finally have their time to shine, their time in the sun. And the last one I highlighted was FRDM, the Freedom Emerging Markets ETF. And this basically, this kind of ties back to the ESG thing I highlighted earlier. It basically invests in countries and companies within countries that have higher freedom weighting, essentially. And what this ends up being is like a kind of ESG score based on countries, because there's a lot of people that just invest in emerging markets. They have an ESG allocation, and then they put tons of money into an emerging markets product that holds, I don't know, 40% in China. And China has historically and is currently doing a lot of things that most ESG proponents would say are terrible for ESG purposes. So from those perspectives, we're watching these types of ETFs and seeing if they can gain a niche or a hold in investor portfolios.
No, I think all interesting ETFs to track. The interest rate hedged ETF category, I think, will be particularly interesting. We saw the flows into inflation type hedge ETFs last year. I think this interest rate hedged ETF category could be one that we see a lot of inflows into. But James, great stuff this week. So glad to finally have you on the podcast. I think it's going to be another fun year in the industry. And I really appreciate everything you and the entire Bloomberg team do covering ETFs. So keep up that excellent work. And thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
That was James Seifert, ETF analyst at Bloomberg Intelligence.